Again, thanks for the invitation to speak to you today, and thank you to the first two speakers for setting up my talk so well. There are several things that I wasn't going to talk about, and I'm glad I didn't talk about them because you guys have talked about them. We're going to talk about sorghum here. We're going to switch crops and first acknowledge that the information I'm going to present to you, like Aaron just said, is a conglomeration of a lot of people's work. I stand in front of the sorghum breeding program, and so I get to present this. And really the purpose, and it's been funded by numerous people ranging from RBE and the Sorghum Checkoff through Texas A&M and others. I want to talk to you today primarily about this from a plant breeding perspective only. And what I mean by that is that the engineering and the computer science that goes on is fantastic, and the collaborators that I have that do that are really key to this project, because the last thing that I ever want to be is a computer science or an engineer, because I don't have the capacity and I don't have the ability. We're looking at this from a perspective, and that's the question that I've always asked as we've gone into this for the past 3 years, is okay, if we're going to use these systems, how do they apply to the breeding program? And where do they fit in the breeding program, and where's their relative value within that context? And so sorghum's what we do, so sorghum's what we are going to look at that in. And our schematic for breeding is over on the left side of this slide. And we do breeding on three different idiotypes of sorghum: grain, forage, and bioenergy. And as you can see from the picture below, those idiotypes are different, and they're going to require a different approach in terms of how you utilize and access information from them, whether it be ground-based systems or UAV or in-canopy or handheld measurements. And so one of our goals in overall this work, and my goal here today, is to walk you through some of our approaches and ideas on how to get information from that. From a practical concept, when I talk about it from a breeding perspective, not from a science per se question, but for us to implement it in the breeding program, it has to be one or more of those concepts on the left side of the slide. It has to be faster, it has to be cheaper, it has to be easier, and then finally, if you hit at least a couple of those or one of those and make it more efficient, then the data that you generate either have to be accurate or they have to be relatively accurate. And what I mean by relatively accurate is if I'm making decisions on what we're going to advance, I'm not particularly concerned if the data is dead on exact, but if it ranks the genotypes consistently so that I can make informed decisions on what needs to go forward, that's really key to where I want to be. And the other thing, and that goes for either existing traits, which we traditionally have measured and talk about on a regular scale, but new traits, and new's in quotes, because these aren't new concepts, they're simply traits that in the past maybe we have not been able to measure simply because we couldn't get out there enough times and develop that concept of what these traits are. So I'll talk a little bit about that. And then lastly, this is an ideal world. It's effective throughout the breeding program, so I can use it on all phases in all situations and apply and deploy that. So we've looked at UAVs, both rotary wing and fixed wing, ground-based platforms, and in within our ARPA-E project, even in canopy phenotyping platforms. And some of the people that are working with us are pictured here, and one of the points that I'm going to say here is I'm not going to talk much about the logistics of collecting this data, because these guys are much better at that and can tell you a lot more detail, and others will as well. Today we're going to talk about data collected from rotary wing and from the in-canopy phenotyping system by Soren and his group and our colleagues at Carnegie Mellon with the in-canopy equipment that we generated, that we developed, that's down here. So the other thing I'm not going to talk about is this, all right? Once that data is collected, and Aaron mentioned it, there's a lot of pictures that are taken, and pictures are really neat, and I like to look at pictures, but pictures aren't statistically analyzable in the sense that I can make informed decisions on them. So I need my cooperators, the computer scientists and the engineers, to turn those pictures into something of an actionable item that I can make decisions based on. And they have done a very good job of establishing a flow system. Our colleagues at Texas A&M Corpus Christi, Jinha Jung, has done a fantastic job of being able to develop a hub system where we can go and look at images that were taken, and literally within a week we have the data if we so choose that. This is a set of these numbers don't mean anything except just to point out the traits we're going to talk about some today. Traits of interest to us are plant height, grain yield, biomass yield, anthracnose disease. The other ones in here, panicle length, panicle width, are all components of traits that we're interested in. And for the past 2 years, we've spent a lot of time using these different systems to measure these traits within the context of the breeding program, at different phases of the breeding program, asking the question, not only can we measure them, but how do they relate when you move through the breeding program at different phases? So I'm going to talk a little bit about the traits that are in red. We collected this data in two locations, in both Corpus Christi and College Station, which are in Central and South Texas, and typical growing regions for sorghum. UAV picture, you've seen this, and extracting information from that can be challenging. That's why I would really like numbers out of these. So if we look at this, I want to talk a little bit first about in-canopy phenotyping, and when we talk about that, we're talking about energy sorghum. So it was an RPE-funded project. Our interest there is in stalk characteristics and leaf characteristics in a canopy. And then complementing that with UAV data over the top, looking at canopy volume and plant height, and can we estimate biomass yields from that. Then we'll move into grain and talk mostly about UAV activities in grain sorghum related to yield components, plant height, and foliar disease resistance. So a few slides on the in canopy, because this one's different and unique, and one of the things about working in a large biomass energy crop is that the plants get tall. They grow for a long growing season, and they lean over. It becomes impossible to pass through those canopy. It becomes impossible to drive through the canopy. And it's really difficult to see over the canopy. Okay? And so getting in and actually visualizing inside the canopy, because most of the biomass and most of the factors affecting that biomass are a function of stem characteristics and somewhat leaf characteristics for photosynthesis within that. And so our concept was originally with RPE to develop a gantry type system. They funded us to evaluate the potential to measure in canopy measurements. And in doing so, we came to a compromise with the equipment that plunges an arm into the canopy and measures within that. And you see it there on the right. There's a more visible picture of it. It phenotypes from the ground up on these plants and gives us visual estimates of stem characteristics and leaf characteristics and whole plant phenotypes. Working with our colleagues at Carnegie Mellon in the machine learning area, they have used these images and done 3D reconstructions and developed algorithms to estimate these stem phytomer characteristics, diameter, leaf angle, leaf area, and extract that information through these different methods so that we now have predictive formulas to estimate, using these different methods of phenotyping, correlations between these traits, and then estimating them back into our genetic populations and eventually into our breeding populations. At this point, we're in the characterization of the genotypes underlying these traits in structured populations. Eventually, our goal is to move this into the breeding program to be able to change leaf angle, assess the role of leaf angle in these biomass crops, and what modifications we can do with stem diameter and internode length within the context of the breeding program, accounting for issues related to lodging and harvestability and productivity. So that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is then relating that back to biomass yield, and ultimately that's because that is the ultimate context in terms of the breeding program, in this case is harvestable biomass yield. So we're relating those information back to information that we've generated on a UAS or UAV scale, okay, looking at these same plots and estimating their yield potential using some of the systems you see down there from NDVI through canopy volume and canopy cover. And in doing so, one of my graduate students, Ace Pugh, has looked at which of those factors and which of those parameters are the most effective in estimating these components, and we've found that canopy volume is actually the most useful, okay, actually physically measuring using a component of plant height and width and depth of canopy coverage has shown us a quite nice correlation. Now, I will qualify that, and if you'll note, what I mean by qualification here is that if you look there on the range of the ground truth data in the upper left corner, that we have quite a range of variation in terms of, these are just in plot weights here, from near 0 and 10 kilograms of fresh weight all the way up to 80. So we have a nice range of genetic variation existing in here. I have to believe that helps us with our correlations when we start to look at this, and I'll come back to that later. This is what I'm talking about with nutrients, and we've already seen a slide like this one. This is also on the biomass project, and we're looking at biomass and forages, and this is the canopy volume over time, measured weekly for about 6-7 weeks. And what was interesting about it was that we saw very distinct growth curve patterns within these materials. Some of that, again, is set up by the fact that we have diversity in this panel and allows you to see that. But what we found is that it maps out very nicely, and we see these patterns associated with the relative maturity of these materials. And that some of them diverge a little bit in the way they act and they interact throughout that cycle. For example, these two lines here, one of which goes on up into its upper category and the other settles down here at the lower level. And so this is kind of interesting to me, and I'm really excited about seeing this thing because it gives us a new way to characterize these materials that we simply did not have in the past. So I'm going to shift now and I'm going to talk a little bit about grain yield. This one, from the grain sorghum side of me, this is the most interesting trait that we work with. All right, within the breeding program, we'll come back to that. If I can indirectly estimate grain yield by looking at panicle number or panicle shape or seed number or whatever, it changes the way we do things completely. Okay, we don't have to take the combine out of the shed for initial evaluations, and that expands the numbers of things that we can look at. And so working with our colleagues down in Corpus Christi, who have been gracious enough to entertain this work with me, they take an approach of, well, first of all, can we estimate panicle number? Then if we can do that, can we look at panicle size? And then let's look at the components and how they affect grain yield. And you see their process there from going from images, plot-based images to DSM, and then to actually estimating and counting number of panicles, and then taking it eventually to the extreme of 3D reconstructions of these things so you can look at the panicles from side views as you see in the bottom. That's pretty neat. When you look at that, and this is a small set of data just from one of the trials. We're expanding this to larger number trials as well, but we wanted to start simply. We had a trial with 20 entries in it, replicated multiple times and two row plots, and we went in ground truth and had Murillo and Jinha do their magic with the computer and looked at correlation. This is just panicle length, and you'll see that the valid in terms of UAS to estimates of panicle length and the actual measured on samples of 5 from each plot were quite good, okay? Now you'll note here that we didn't measure the same 5 panicles with ground truth and with the computer estimation because it's kind of hard to align up and coordinate, oh, we're gonna measure these 5 panicles, you measure those. That was logistically difficult, but even without doing that, we see a nice correlation. Now that's just panicle length. When we look at that relative to grain yield, which was also collected on these trials, what you'll see is that upper right corner block here. There's the correlation between the two panicle lengths, tight like it was before. Here's the relationship with manual panicle length and plot weight. Here's the UAS estimate, and you'll note that both of those are a little bit larger spread. Neither one of them are that good. As a breeder, that didn't surprise me too much because panicle length is not the only defining factor in grain yield. And so the correlation, the R-square on that was lower. And quite frankly, probably not enough to be useful. Again, a common theme here that I'll point out, we had on purpose a wide range of variability and yield potential in these particular lines to be able to pick that up if we saw that. So we added panicle sizing to this using several different methods from point mapping, entitled, and don't ask me any more about it because I know no more about it, but one of them was cylinder and one of them was disc stacking, okay? That's all I know. And asked the question, does this improve the process if we add this to the component with panicle length? And the answer is yes, it does. Now you see the R-squares. This is the same set of field data with the panicle number and now adding in the feature extraction on the panicle size using either cylinder or disc stacking, and you'll see that those R-squares go up to 0.66 and 0.77. And so now we're starting to get in the range where it's getting interesting, all right? And if we add some other growth parameters to this that Marilla has done, it gets a little higher as well. So we're looking pretty good. Which brings me to the last topic, which is where I want to bring some of these points together because we've gotten farthest on this. We all know that we can probably measure plant height pretty well with UAS systems. Why worry about it in sorghum? Well, plant height is a factor in determining which types of hybrids get moved forward in a grain breeding program. It's primarily a concern of producers. It deals with machine harvestability and lodging concerns that they have, and they don't like hybrids that are too tall. So we have to put caps on that. And so we asked the question over, can we estimate, and when we estimate these plant height measurements, UAS, how do they relate and how do they fit directly into our breeding program? And so you see correlations, and these are two correlations from the studies that we made at different time points, and you see the R-squares are good. As the one on the left is earlier in the season, the one on the right is a little later in the season, and this is across everything. Grain sorghums, biomass sorghums, the total gamut, and you'll see the ranges on those are quite high. The question comes is that when you start to look within these groups, these smaller groups, does the correlation still hold and is it still relevant? Because as you go through a breeding program, you go from a wide set of variation to a much narrower set of variation as you go through the breeding process. And that's what we're talking about here. And so what we really did in this study that I want to highlight in different is we took sets of material, and in that data that we had defined sets of germplasm or phases of the breeding program. Specifically, we had a set of early hybrids in early evaluation, first time we'd seen them. Lots of variation exists in those materials, and we can see that greatly different. We took from the advanced set of materials, which had gone through two or three years of evaluation, we knew they were going to be in the range of acceptable heights, and can we discern between those? And so it gets down to breaking that variation up into these things and getting back to efficient rank and discrimination of that material with the variation you have. And our prediction was it's going to be a little more difficult in the elite material. And so what I will show you here is a few slides just in terms of genetic variance components, repeatabilities, and correlations, and then show you some ranking differences. If you compare those two trials, and this is data just from one of the locations in College Station, we did this at both locations. What the first thing that will jump out to you in this graph is that the early hybrid trials here on the left, advanced hybrid trials on the right, this dark blue line on both of them is the percent of variation explained by genotype. And you'll note in the early generation trial, it's much higher. It drops in the advanced generation trial, primarily because the range of variation between these two has been reduced due to selection. No big surprises there. When we look at repeatability of those height and measurements over time within these two groups, and again here on the bottom we have the early hybrids set here, on the advanced hybrids set here over time, and then repeatability on those measurements over here on both of them in the same categories, early at the bottom, advanced on the type, you'll note the repeatabilities are quite good on both, so we could measure what we were measuring accurately. However, the correlation, and when I say correlation here, I'm talking about a correlation between UAS estimate and ground truth estimates, tended to be much higher in the early hybrids than they were in the advanced hybrids. Again, not too shocking that. Now, I'm not going to lay all the blame of this on the UAS people and the UAV and our engineers. A lot of that is on us because especially early in the process, we don't do a good job of measuring height because no one likes to bend over and do this. Okay, or they don't like to look up and do that, and the angle is off. And so there's some issues there related to that. But nevertheless, there was better correlations in the earlier hybrids. Which brings me, I think, to near my last slide, which is to talk about the ranks. And this is where it comes down for me as a breeder. If I'm going to use this information in the program, I have to use it to make decisions. And can I replace what I've got already, which is in place? And if we take and we say, and these graphs show the early hybrids on the left, the advanced hybrids on the right, height estimates, LS mean height estimates, using in the left set of columns here using ground truth estimates, on the right using the UAS system, and what you'll see is that I just did something I shouldn't do. How do I get back? How do I leave? There it goes. Oh, that was weird. If we set a cutoff of 1.4 meters and we say that's too high, if you look in the early hybrids, what you'll see is that the pink or the brown up on your screen were the ones that were too high. And if you look over in the UA estimate, you look at those and you say, well, they matched pretty well. We had one flip, okay? But they ranked those materials and they put them into their categories very well. And so we would get rid of the material in brown on the left. That would be with the ground truth. And that same list is very consistent with one flip on the right. Good. I'm happy about that. On the left, or I'm sorry, on the right side of the slide, when you look at the advanced, you see the list down at the bottom of the same category that we would break through. And when we look at that with the UAS, it's less accurate. We see more flips and we see more turns, and it's a little less consistent. And I think this comes back to that variation that we're working with and the ability to discern at that height. And if you look at this, the range in height between these two trials in the middle of the slide, it shows one point. We have from the shortest to the tallest in the early was 1.26 meters. Shortest to tallest in the advanced was 0.5. So our range dropped. Our ability to discriminate dropped. And so you look at that and you go, as a breeder, would I use that in an early phase evaluation? Absolutely. Would I use it in the late phase? Less likely right now. Can it get better? I'm sure it can. I'm sure it will. This reminds me a lot of 20 years ago when genetic technologies were coming into play. Exactly the same type of thing was occurring. And so right now, we're very optimistic about using these technologies, especially in early phase breeding. That's where we see the real value. If I don't have to get the combine out and combine a few plots to get yield estimates on first phase hybrids, that saves an incredible amount of time. It expands where I can grow them and evaluate them. It expands the number that I can look at, and it allows me to do better yield testing on later generation material. And so I would just leave this with the concept of, we'll adopt it. Breeders will adopt these things if we can see that they measure new traits, they're applicable across the breeding program, and they're accurate or relatively accurate, cheaper, faster than the traditional methods that we've been using. And so when we look at sorghum, where we have relatively modest breeding programs, I think these things will become very important, and the future is in determining when, where, and how we use them as we move through the breeding program. So, with credits to Murillo, a nice picture of one of the overall fields, I will conclude there and entertain any questions. Yes, sir.
For your ground-based plant height measurements, is it just like a single plot? plant, or is it like the average canopy?
So it was the depending on the time of the year, the stage of the growth of the crop, the plants were measured on a plot basis. Okay, we went through it and we took the mean of the plot visually. Okay, so it was based on a stick on the ground with a graduate student and a barcode reader looking across the length of the plot. So it was not individual plants. Yes, Jeff.
Bill, are you looking at all the thermal data or spectral? This looks at the very sort of morphology focus.
Right, and we do have some of that information. We're starting to bring that into the system, okay? But we have not processed any of it at this point in time, so we don't have the thermal data yet.
Do you have a feeling that the sort of gross morphology is going to give you 90% of what you need,
I would answer that question. It depends on where you're at, where we're at in our breeding program. Early stages, I think it can. Okay, later stages, I don't think it's going to, because we're diminishing our variation and it's harder to discriminate. Yes, Jimmy.
Bill, can you comment on the in the future, how do you combine all this this time in research stage collaboration into your established upline?
Yeah, that's always a challenge, and maybe it came across in terms of the logistics of doing this. It all comes down to how you can work it in and who you're working with. And the first thing I'll say right then and there is that I like watching people fly these things and run them. I don't want to do it, okay? I really want to be able to purchase a service that will generate that information for me and hand me or send me on an email or let me download from a hub or whatever that information. Okay, ultimately that to me is the pattern that I would look at, and I think those things are coming. You look at Blue River and some of those technology companies that are starting to develop those systems. And I think ultimately that's where it's going to be, because I don't think every breeding program is going to run out there and manage a fleet of UAVs and a data set organization any more than we would build our own combines and troubleshoot them. Amir?
Bill, you know, you can digitize this now. You can get numbers from PNR and more low. How do you envision the integration of this with the market data into a single platform that can help you, in the selection?
Right. How do you bring the marker data into the phenomic data? I think that's very crop specific. Okay. I think each crop has to evolve that, because each crop has different technologies in terms of how and when they'll do evaluations of decisions for advancement and when they would extract information off a genomic perspective. I think, if you look at the corn system, it's pretty well laid out. It's pretty simple to see how they do that. But in crops where we don't do doubled haploids or we have hybrids that we have to test, you're going to have to pick those times to integrate all of that information into that. And so I think that's still to be determined, Amir. I don't know in our program yet how that's going to work. I think it's something that's it's got to evolve a little bit. Yes, sir.
Did you have to make any changes in the
Yes, we have had to acknowledge that we've been doing this 3 years, and I'll tell you that really the first year was a complete learning experience, and I tried to do as many things wrong as I possibly could, and I was successful at that. We have. One of the things that we've learned is that when you're measuring these things, especially with UAS systems, that shadow effects are real and they affect the height estimates that you get on neighboring plots. And so we've gone to grouping things that we think have a little higher potential for on height and things like that in different ways. In the future, I see it changing dramatically the way we do things for some of the reasons mentioned previously. If I don't have to do yield trials, if I don't have to put a combine in trials, and I can change the way we do that and get height and yield measurements right up top without doing that, it's going to change a lot of things the way we do things. Yes.
Thanks, Bill. We really need to have a bunch of time.